This is Artist Stories, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. I'm your host, Eva Romero. Today, I'm with Betty Villegas, director of the Mexican American Heritage and History Museum. Welcome, Betty.
I appreciate you inviting me to be here with you today.
Betty, the Mexican American Museum at the Sosa Carrillo House was founded by the group Los Descendientes del Presidio de Tucson in order to promote and preserve the rich heritage of the Old Pueblo. How long have you been around, and how did this all get started?
Los Descendientes del Presidio de Tucson was incorporated in 1990 and started by a group of pioneer families that were descendants of the Old Pueblo that had been here in Tucson for many, many generations. They felt that they wanted to form this organization to really make sure that people didn't forget about the pioneers, first of all, and didn't forget about their families. And they wanted to educate the community on who they were and the contributions that their families have made and the contributions that many Mexican American people have made in this region.
Could you describe the museum to us and tell us a little bit about some exhibits or events that you've hosted?
Although the organization has been around since 1990, something that was on their wish list was always to have a place that they could call home, that they could have as a convening and also as a center where they could display some of their artifacts and pictures and history. If you can imagine, from 1990 to 2018, it took that long for us to finally find a home. It came about when the Arizona Historical Society was renting the historic Sosa Carrillo House to a nonprofit, another nonprofit, who was having some difficult times and they weren't able to afford the rent anymore, so they were going to vacate. And when we heard about this, it was an opportunity for us to ask the Arizona Historical Society if Los Descendientes could take over and lease from them and make this a museum for the purpose of education of our heritage and our history without disturbing some of the museum exhibit that was already here, which pays tribute to the original families that resided in this house. So this house was built around the 1880s. The first family that resided here were the Sosa family. The Sosa family transferred it over to the Carrillo family. Leopoldo Carrillo had significant funding for that time, and he was able to do some restoration and expand the house. His family consistently have lived here since then. He was owner of many properties in the Tucson area, specifically in the Barrio Viejo area, starting with the Mission Gardens, basically. He had a lot of influence in the Tucson area during that time. Over the years, obviously, this house was in the middle of the barrio, and it had become many things, from a home to a big family. And at one point, it then was transformed into small apartments where some of the families still lived here, but it was also a boarding house. And so at one point, the story goes, the governor of this territory at the time was Governor Fremont, and he had a daughter that stayed here for a few months here at the Sosa Carrillo House. And he came to visit maybe once or twice, so the story goes. During urban renewal, when everything was being destroyed in the surrounding area, all the neighborhoods were being torn down, there was a group that was trying to save as many properties as they could. This house was one of them. And the case that was made to the city was that the governor lived here at one point. So then it became the governor's mansion. And the house was saved. Although it had many, many issues, there was, because of urban renewal, as if you know the history, the city had stopped investing in the neighborhood. And so there were a lot of infrastructure issues, and they stopped picking up their trash. So it looked dilapidated, because that was the purpose for them to get the funding for urban renewal. So this house needed a lot of work, because the other issue that was happening is because it was in an area that was redlined, if you're familiar with the term from a banking and housing perspective, where banks wouldn't lend to these redlined areas because they were high risk. So because the area was so dilapidated, lenders would not lend to the families that owned the houses even before urban renewal to do improvements. And so when the city actually bought the property, and it was not something that was easy, because the last person that lived here was part of the Carrillo family, and she really fought to the end to try to stay here until she couldn't fight anymore, and they actually implemented the eminent domain and were able to force her to move out. They gave her some money to move out, and the city took over. And they really didn't do anything with the house. And finally, in the early 70s, or maybe late 60s, they transferred the property to the Arizona Historical Society, who then, at that time, were well-funded by the state, and they did a major rehabilitation of the property, trying to preserve as much of the house as they could, but having to replace many of the items in the house in order to make it safe and livable. So the Arizona Historical Society was really the one that made the major improvements to keep this house presentable. And it's been here ever since. So it's been many things. For many years, it was part of the Arizona Historical Society, and they had it as a museum, and they really tried to make sure that everything in here was from the period. When the state started reducing their funding, it was really hard for them to maintain the houses that they had bought. At one point, they even had to close down this museum, and it was closed for a long time. And it would reopen, and then it would close again, and it went through many different stages, but finally they did rent it, as I said earlier, to Borderlands Theater was the name of the group that had it before us. You know, they were charging them for the whole space, and expected them to have the house open, because it does draw a lot of people that are curious about the architecture in the house and in the inside and the outside. And it was really difficult for them, because they had a very small staff and they were going through some financial reductions as well. So when they went to the Historical Society and we had heard about it, and we talked with the Arizona Historical Society, they were very supportive of what we wanted to do. And all they asked of us is to make sure that we keep a couple of the rooms as exhibit museum rooms, and the rest of the house we can really work with in whatever way we want. And the good thing about that is that we were able to offer the Borderlands Theater an office space here. So they pay a portion of the rent, and they're a good tenant, if you will.
Well, and Borderland Theaters, if I remember correctly, did a series of performances to kind of help create awareness around the history of what happened in the area that is, you know, the TCC area today, with urban renewal, with everybody being kind of displaced, the Sosa Carrillo house being the singular kind of survivor from that era, correct?
Right, correct. And this was before we moved in when they had the space. They did their barrio stories that was based on Doctora Lidia Otero's book La Calle. Yeah, it was wonderful. They activated the entire TCC campus, including the Sosa Carrillo house, where it was a backdrop to one of the stages. And it really showed what happened, you know, what urban renewal was, the destruction, how families really felt, and what was really going on behind the scenes that a lot of people didn't really hear about or know about.
What do you think every Tucsonan should know about our heritage and history, and maybe specifically our Mexican-American heritage and history?
Well, from the Mexican-American heritage and history, I believe that everyone needs to know the history of how we came here, how long we were here, the migration that took place between Mexico and Tucson, where our families would go back and forth. It's very important, especially for our newcomers, to know that this was part of Mexico. And we were part of Mexico until the Gadsden Purchase, which happened in 1853, I believe. And from that point on is when changes started to happen. But we were already here. And I think it's important for people to know that the contributions that we have made from the very beginning are many, and those stories have not always been told. And I believe that that's one of the reasons why we have a lot of division even within our own culture, because people don't understand the history, even though, you know, we always try to look forward and the present and forward. You need to look at that. You need to look at your history in order to know where you're going in the future, and learn from it, and really take pride in it, you know, because it's important. The other part of the history that is very important to me and to many here is that we are on Tohono O'odham land, right? Even as Mexican Americans, we were not the first ones here. And so we always have to acknowledge that. We have learned so much from each other, and where we got our start, you know, was right where the Mission Gardens is now, really, you know, so, and where there's so much history here in Tucson specifically. I mean, our Tohono O'odham brothers and sisters have been here for 3,000 years or even longer, maybe, so. You know, there's so much history here. And I think that's one of the reasons people are really flocking to move here.
I have seen it on Los Descendientes website and elsewhere, that area that you speak of, the Mission Gardens, the Sentinel Peak base area, you know, the shadow of the Black Mountain, is reputed to be the oldest continually inhabited area in the United States. And that always just really blows my mind. And I've said it before too, it just feels really special. It has a special energy, and it's almost like you can sense that there have been thousands of years of energy and life in this area. Betty, I ask everyone about their COVID-19 pivot. How has the museum had to adapt?
Well, it's been really difficult for us because Los Descendientes del Presidio de Tucson, which is the umbrella organization that runs this museum, most of us, and I'll include myself, are elders, right? We're 65 and older, although in the past couple of years, we have had some younger people interested and who have joined our organization. But for the most part, those of us that have been very committed to the museum and volunteering here as docents, you know, everyone is a volunteer. First of all, no one gets paid. We're all volunteers. Everything that we've done here, we started with a small grant from the Southwest Foundation for Education and Historic Preservation. They were our first funder, and we were so happy because we were able to buy a computer and upgrade our chairs and tables and many things that were needed. One of the agreements with the Arizona Historical Society was that they did not have the funding to do any improvements to anything that we really wanted to do. We'd have to fund ourselves. They do a good job of keeping up the structure and anything major, but anything beyond that, it's up to us. And so we were on track. I mean, we started in 2018. Our first exhibit was in April of 2018. And we learned how to run a museum really, really quick. And we had a wonderful first exhibit on the history of women in mariachi, which went through the end of May. And then we've had a couple of other exhibits. We had, of course, when Neto Portillo retired, we had an exhibit showcasing some of his columns from over the years at the Arizona Daily Star, and had a really nice reception for him here, honoring all his contributions, all his stories. I mean, talk about some great stories and contributions from our community. You know, he has, somebody really needs to compile all of them and write a book. But that was a really nice exhibit, and we had that here for a couple months. And then before that, though, we also had a really nice exhibit on Dolores Gonzalez, who was a seamstress and a business owner here in Tucson, and really made resort wear famous throughout the United States. The Tucson Historic Foundation had the exhibit already, and so they curated and displayed many of her beautiful wear, and it was really nice. And I thank Damian Klinko for that. He did a really good job, and he really was one of my guides in exhibiting the first exhibit as well. So he's been really helpful to us. After Netos, and you know, the holidays were coming, and so we had the Dia de los Muertos exhibit with a beautiful reception, and then we had our Dia de la Virgen in December, and it was beautiful as well. And we were on the verge of opening up a new exhibit right before COVID, which is the Veil exhibit, which is called Ranchos, Vaqueros y Familia. And it's really telling the story of the many contributions of our Mexican cowboys, right, who moved into the Empire Valley and homes, many of them homesteaded land there. And they had little ranches, and the bigger ranches, then they would go work on these bigger ranches, these rancheros, vaqueros. And that's how they supported their families. But they had many ties to Tucson, and they continue to do so. And so it was a huge research project, and it's a beautiful exhibit displaying some of these families that continue to have roots in Vail, but also here in Tucson. And I encourage, as soon as we open, everybody to come in and see it, because we're going to keep it up until we can actually have that opening and time frame. Going back to your question about how we have had to make adjustments with COVID, our group has continued to meet. Because we have so many elders, it was very important to me that they not come, you know, that they not be here. And so we had to close down, as many people did. Other businesses did, and other museums did. We had to close down for quite a while. And then we had by appointment, and we still do. If someone wants to come, if someone's in town and they want to take a quick look around, we will work with them on getting somebody here to show them, and safely, of course, with limited people. We've never turned anyone away if they want to come and see the house, but it's not open publicly. It's by appointment only at this time, I guess you can say. But we kept trying to figure out how are we going to survive if we're not having our annual gala, which was our signature fundraising event, to help us run this museum. And how are we going to survive if we're not able to rent the patio for small events? Because that was another way in which we were receiving revenue, was through renting the patio and sometimes even the indoor areas to groups that wanted to have a meeting here, wanted to have a reception here, and even small weddings and small fundraising events. You know, it's not a huge patio, but we've had quite a few events back there. You know, we were constantly trying to reinvent ourselves at every meeting, but because, as I said earlier, we're all volunteers, it was hard to really focus in on how, on the how, right? So in 2020, probably in November, I had Diana Olivares come to me and say, you know, we really want to perform. We started this all-female group. We really want to perform. And it's really sad because there's nowhere for us to perform. So it was during the time when the COVID had eased up a bit. The CDC and the health department had some guidelines on how many people could come to events. And so we decided, let's give it a shot. Let's give it a try. So we did. And we had a couple of successful small concerts that we were able to do virtually with YouTube and Facebook, because the other part of it was I didn't want to just do Facebook, because a lot of our membership, they don't really follow social media. It was important to me that we have YouTube, which I knew that they would be able to sign on to and would be willing to sign on to. We were successful at that. And then that's when we decided we need to do this. We can't stop. We have to move forward. We have to go virtual. So we are working on a plan right now. And thanks to the grant that the Arts Foundation and Somos Uno was able to provide to us, we now feel that we have the resources to really move forward on some programming that we're planning, such as we're going to be starting a virtual Mexican-American focused genealogy 101. One of our members, she was ready to go right before the pandemic. And then when it hit, you know, she stopped everything. And I recently talked to her and I said, I could set you up in the office. And her husband's pretty techie. So, you know, they could use our Zoom to provide these workshops. So we're going to start those within the next month. We'll start doing our outreach and to get people interested in attending. We found that many people, if you go to Facebook, if you're on Facebook, some of the best scrolling that I do are on these Remembering Tucson groups, Ancestors to Sonora, you know, because that's where my family's from, and Ancestors to Chihuahua, you know, that's where my other ancestors are at. So, and you know, there's a huge following of people wanting to know their history and know their ancestry. And so when we looked at other genealogy, yes, there are a few in town, and there are some that do some work in Mexican-American, but not that are totally focused on it. And so we thought that this was a good opportunity for us to do that. And by that, you know, we're also hoping to collect stories that we can archive and make part of our preservation as well, because that's something that we also is in our mission, you know, to safeguard our places and to make sure that we're preserving our history and heritage. We're going to start that program. We're also looking at having a Valentine's Day concert and installation of our officers, which we'll be doing online as well. We just started working on that, but that's our plan short term, to invite a couple of artists to perform and then have our installation and welcome everybody online. That'll be our opening online virtual programming. But one of the other items that we're really focused on as well, to bring people back together in a safe way, is to look at our front area, which encompasses a pretty large area. If you've ever driven by the house, you'll see the structure. So what we're going to do is we're in the process of talking to a couple of architects to see about re-envisioning, reimagining, readapting the front space to be more open and useful to community. One thing that is important that we've learned from this pandemic is the need for more outdoor space. And so we're thinking if we can transform the front of the house to a beautiful landscaped plaza with a kiosk, or we have a fountain in front now, but it's pretty dilapidated and doesn't have a real historic significance. So we've been told that we could remove it, replace it, or put something else there. And we're looking at different options that we'll use for that, so that we can have space out there to convene, right? People can have events, small events, safely spaced. And once we are back to normal, then it's going to be a space that can still be used for so many months out of the year when the weather is nice, which we're blessed to have many of those months.
I've often wondered why we don't have more outdoor spaces. I mean, pre-COVID, I always wondered why we didn't have more outdoor spaces and more al fresco dining and more, you know, good utilization of beautiful views, etc. So in some ways, I see that as a bit of a silver lining of this period, is that it's kind of forced everyone to re-examine how they can better utilize outdoor space. Betty, could you tell us more about yourself? You've had a really fascinating trajectory in terms of the way your life and professionally and personally has really threaded together health, housing, and culture in our community.
Thank you. I love the way that you put that together, because it wasn't until recently that, you know, when you have time to really think about your life and some of the things that you've done, that I've realized how interconnected my passions are. First of all, I am a native born Tucsonan, first and foremost. My parents are both from Tucson, and they passed away in 1969 when I was 16 years old. And I have a brother, an older brother, a younger brother, and a younger sister who passed coming up on 6 years. You know, I had a wonderful upbringing up until that point, living in the Menlo Park neighborhood. Somehow, I ended up as a real advocate for affordable housing. And it started with my career in banking, where I ended up as a manager of a savings bank. I had to become a loan officer, a mortgage loan officer. And that started me on this path where I realized how important housing is to people. It was important to me because I had a rough time for many years and lived at many different places and never thought I would have my own home. So when I did and I realized it was possible, I just knew that it's important for everyone. If it's important to me, then it's important to everyone to have a safe space that they can call home, that they can build and learn how to preserve it, right? So we have our home and we know that we have to take care of it. That was my love for housing. And within that time, I've also always been very much in tune with my Mexican culture, and that came from my mother, because especially with music, because my mother was an avid listener of music. I mean, she loved rancheras, you know, that was her passion. As I got older, I learned to love mariachi music, and especially after I introduced my daughter to the genre, and she loved it. And so we became a mariachi family when she joined Los Changuitos Feos at the age of 11. And so in that, I realized how important culture is. And over the years, you know, when you're in Changuitos Feos, you only stay there till you graduate from high school. So my daughter was there for, I don't know, 8 years. And I stayed on for 17 years because I loved the organization and what it stood for, which is preserving our music and our heritage and our culture, while at the same time providing opportunities for our youth to attend higher education. With that came the start of my historic preservation. And then, of course, as I said, my mother passed away. She passed away from ovarian cancer. And my sister and I both got breast cancer. And so we were tested and found we had the BRCA genetic mutation, the same one that Angelina Jolie has. And so, and she made it famous, you know, we had it way before, but, you know, she made people realize that there is such a thing and the importance of knowing your family history. My sister and I, we researched our history and we realized that my mom was a carrier of the mutation after her and I both tested positive for the genetic mutation. And so we became health advocates. We were out there. Well, I would drag her along with me. She wasn't, you know, she wasn't as much of an extrovert as I was until I got her there. But so we started doing a lot of work and outreach on trying to bring attention to, especially to Latina women, about the importance of knowing your history and the importance of preventing cancer, you know, from even invading your body, if possible, when you do find that you have that mutation. There are things you can do to prevent. I became an advocate for women's health. As I went through my life, those three things were always interconnected. You know, I mean, if I talked to somebody about housing, they always knew that I was also involved in historic preservation and culture and health, you know. So it became a part of my identity, I believe, with these three things always interconnected and always a part of who I am. And I continue to be. I'm still very much an advocate for housing and for health. Being in the position that I was in as the interim board of supervisors really opened my eyes to the health issues, you know, not just what's happening now, but all the inequities that have happened in our health system. And so I became an advocate for making sure that we address the systemic racism and inequities that happens in our government and in our lives. You know, we have to really address those things in order to change it. Right now, I just took on another job as the housing director for the Public Housing Authority of South Tucson. And yesterday I did a walkthrough of the apartment complexes and some of the units. And I realized that I have a lot of work to do. And that's one of the reasons that I couldn't retire. You know, I had originally retired actually in 2016 from Pima County's housing as the housing manager and director of the housing center. I did take a break from housing. Not a total break, but from the bureaucracy of working in government, I should say. When I was able to go back and as the board of supervisor, I realized that there is so much work to be done and I'm not ready to stop. So here I am working a full-time job again, although I'm still running the museum because that's important to me. and I'm still an advocate for health and focusing on the inequities and the racism. So yeah, I as I'm telling you everything, I realize that I guess I'm doing a lot.
Clearly, you have done a lot and are doing a lot. And, you know, as is the case, I think, with people who have vision and can see how much work there is to do, you know, you can forget how much you're doing because you're looking at the great need. And that's kind of where you're always focusing, is on the great need and not so much taking some inventory of everything you've actually done.
I also just became a member recently of the YWCA, which I really love what they do in our community. So I'm excited to be part of that board. That's something else that's very important to me. And I try to encourage our younger people to really get engaged and be at the table, you know, join boards, join commissions, join task forces. You know, it's a good way for them to know what's going on, and it's a good way to build relationships and to build their network as well.
Since you had mentioned equity and the importance of it, I was hoping that you could say a few words about what we can do, I guess, to increase equity in the way we do things.
Oh boy, that's a big one. But I always say start at home, start in your own home, right? When I was recently on the Pima County Board of Supervisors board, one of the first things that I looked at coming in during the height of the pandemic was that, you know, the people that I represented weren't really getting the attention that they needed with testing and messaging. And from that grew this report that I had staff work on with me on identifying where are these hotspots of the virus, and are we there with testing, and are we there with messaging that's culturally relevant to them? And we saw a lot of gaps, you know, and even though the public health department was, you know, doing the best that they knew how, I felt that they were still missing a lot. I mean, when I first got there and I started asking those questions, they kept telling me that it was all in nursing homes, congregate homes, and that's where you're seeing the hotspots, in those zip codes. And with my housing background, I've always had to work with census tracts. And so I felt that if we could get into the census tract level, we could get a better idea as to, are they really all congregate homes or not? Because zip codes are pretty spread out, and it's hard to tell, you know, where the real where the real problems are, unless you know it's a nursing home that, you know, that has had a large outbreak. And that happened, you know, there's no question about it. But I kept seeing our side of town grow redder and redder, and nobody was really moving on it. And I felt it was important that I show them what we found, which was overlapping the census tracts. We found that what we already really knew is that the majority of the people that were contracted on our side of town were, and that's where the hottest spots were essential workers, people that were working in nursing homes and bringing it back to their families, people that were working in restaurants and grocery stores and, you know, delivering and construction that hadn't stopped, custodial work. These were the people that live in many of these neighborhoods, and they live in multi-generational homes. And so we provided a report to our county administration and our public health department, and brought out these inequities that were occurring. From that report, we feel that we were able to get better messaging. What I did is I formed a task group from community people so that they could tell us, you know, what are you missing? What are the people that you serve? What are they missing? What are they not getting? You know, why are they not wearing the mask? Why are they not safely distancing? So we were able to get some of those questions answered to determine what type of messaging had to be done. And so we really worked hard. We worked hard with, and the county was very receptive to what we were doing for the most part. I mean, there's always more that they could do, in my opinion. But they did, you know, they supported most of what I was asking for. And one of the things in our report that we had put out was that, you know, we have a couple of mobile health units that go out to community for vaccines and different times of the year. Why are we not using these mobile units to get testing to the areas that need it? Some people don't have cars. They use public transportation. That puts them at higher risk. We need to go to them. And so those are the things that we put in our report. Those things were implemented. You know, we have mobile units now. We have pop-ups. That was the other thing we did is, you know, let's do some pop-up testing. Let's get more testing on our side of town. And those things happened, you know, and I'm not saying it was just me because it wasn't, you know, I mean, it was obviously, you know, just knowing that the virus was spreading and it kept spreading. And, you know, a lot of us from the report and from things that we learned, you know, kept expanding that. But the major thing is that, you know, we saw that the other issue with why our area was also a hotspot is because they had the underlying conditions, right? And those are things that make anyone that gets the virus more susceptible to getting it even worse. Those inequities are some that, you know, we're trying to address. And the good thing is that from that came the resolution that I introduced and that was passed, where we actually called out racism and inequities as a public health crisis. You know, it was passed. So we have a resolution on the books. And that's one of the things that I told Supervisor Grijalva, you know, please make sure this moves forward. Please make sure that it doesn't just get filed away and forgotten. You know, we have to find a way to use health policy in all policy. Everything we do, we should look at with that lens, you know, and including housing, you know, and that's another reason why housing is so tied to health, you know, because healthy communities require safe, decent, and safe housing for everyone. I once went to a forum where this doctor talked about how housing itself should be a vaccine, meaning everyone should have one, you know, everyone should have access to a safe, decent home.
And many communities that have provided housing as part of their, you know, health initiatives and initiatives to keep people out of emergency rooms have seen really good outcomes.
Right. Right. I mean, there's been so many studies done and we have some good programming. I mean, I really have a really high expectations of our public health department now, being a part of it, being on the Board of Health for the 9 months that I was there, and knowing the person that they hired as the director for the public health department. She brings a lot of experience in equity work, and she was one of the first ones I showed the report to, and she was very impressed with it, and it aligned with some of her goals for the future as well.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Betty.
You're welcome.
This has been Artist Stories with Ava Romero, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. To listen to more podcasts, visit kxci.org. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. Support for Artist Stories is provided by Benjamin Supply, presenting a full spectrum of hardware and plumbing fixtures for kitchen and bath, and their Gallery Tucson, offering national and local art in both the Tucson Warehouse and Transfer Buildings on 6th Street and 7th Avenue. Call 777-7000 or visit BenjaminSupply.com or GalleryTucson.com.